the underlying criticism that the struggling classes weren't doing enough to improve their lives. And it worked. Between 2004 and 2014, for-profit enrollment tripled, and the industry now accounts for 11% of the country's college and university students. The marketing of these universities is a far cry from the early promise of the internet as a great equalizing and democratizing force. If it was true during the early dot-com days that nobody knows you're a dog, it's the exact opposite today. We are ranked, categorized, and scored in hundreds of models on the basis of our revealed preferences and patterns. This establishes a powerful basis for legitimate ad campaigns, but it also fuels their predatory cousins. Ads that pinpoint people in great need and sell them false or overpriced promises. They find inequality and feast on it. The result is that they perpetuate our existing social stratification, with all of its injustices. The greatest divide is between the winners in our system, like our venture capitalist, and the people his models prey upon. Anywhere you find the combination of great need and ignorance, you'll likely see predatory ads. If people are anxious about their sex lives, predatory advertisers will promise them Viagra or Cialis or even penis extensions. If they are short of money, offers will pour in for high-interest payday loans. If their computer is acting sludgy, it might be a virus inserted by a predatory advertiser who will then offer to fix it. And as we'll see, the boom in for-profit colleges is fueled by predatory ads. When it comes to WMDs, predatory ads practically define the genre. They zero in on the most desperate among us at enormous scale. In education, they promise what's usually a false road to prosperity, while also calculating how to maximize the dollars they draw from each prospect. Their operations cause immense and nefarious feedback loops and leave their customers buried under mountains of debt. And the targets have little idea how they were scammed because the campaigns are opaque. They just pop up on the computer and later call on the phone. The victims rarely learn how they were chosen or how the recruiters came to know so much about them. Consider Corinthian College. Until recently, it was a giant in the industry. Its various divisions had more than 80,000 students, the great majority of them receiving government finance loans. In 2013, the for-profit college got busted by the Attorney General of California for lying about job placement rates, overcharging students, and using unofficial military seals and predatory ads to reel in vulnerable people. The complaint pointed out that one of its divisions, Everest University Online's Brandon Campus, charged $68,800 in tuition for an online bachelor's degree in paralegal. Such courses cost less than $10,000 at many traditional colleges around the country. Moreover, according to the complaint, Corinthian College targeted isolated, impatient individuals with low self-esteem who have few people in their lives who care about them and who are stuck and unable to see and plan well for future. The complaint called Corinthian College's practices, quote, unlawful, unfair, and fraudulent. In 2014, amid more reports of abuses, the Obama administration put a hold on the company's access to federal student loan funding. That was its lifeblood. In mid-2015, the company sold off most of its campuses and declared Chapter 11 bankruptcy. But the industry marches on. Vatterott College, a career training institute, is a particularly nasty example. A 2012 Senate committee report on for-profit colleges described Vatterott's recruiting manual, which sounds diabolical. It directs recruiters to target welfare moms with kids, pregnant ladies, recent divorce, low self-esteem, low-income jobs, experienced a recent death, physically mentally abused, recent incarceration, drug rehabilitation, dead-end jobs, no future. Why specifically were they targeting these folks? Vulnerability is worth gold. It always has been. Picture an itinerant quack in an old Western movie. He pulls into town with his wagon full of jangling jars and bottles. When he sits down with an elderly prospective customer, he seeks out her weaknesses. She covers her mouth when she smiles, indicating that she's sensitive about her bad teeth. She anxiously twirls her old wedding ring, which, from the looks of her swollen knuckle, will be stuck there till the end of her days, arthritis. So, when he pitches his products to her, he focuses on the ugliness of her teeth and her aching hands. He could promise to restore the beauty of her smile and wash away the pain from her joints. With this knowledge, he knows he's halfway to a sale before even clearing his throat to speak. The playbook for predatory advertisers is similar, but they carry it out at massive scale, targeting millions of people every day. The customer's ignorance, of course, is a crucial piece of the puzzle. Many of the targeted students are immigrants who come to this country believing that private universities are more prestigious than public ones. This argument is plausible if the private universities happen to be Harvard and Princeton. But the idea that DeFry or the University of Phoenix would be preferable to any state university, much less public gems such as Berkeley, Michigan, or Virginia, is something only newcomers to the system could ever believe. Once the ignorance is established, the key for the recruiter, just as for the snake oil merchant, is to locate the most vulnerable people and then use their private information against them. This involves finding where they suffer the most, which is known as the pain point. It might be low self-esteem, the stress of raising kids in a neighborhood of warring gangs, or perhaps a drug addiction. Many people unwittingly disclose their pain points when they look for answers on Google or later when they fill out college questionnaires. With that valuable nugget in hand, recruiters simply promise that an expensive education at their university will provide the solution and eliminate the pain. Quote, "We deal with people that live in the moment and for the moment," Vatterott's training materials explain. "Their decision to start, stay in school, or quit school is based more on emotion than logic. Pain is the greater motivator in the short term." A recruiting team at ITT Technical Institute went so far as to draw up an image of a dentist bearing down on a patient in agony with the words, quote, "Find out where their pain is." A potential student's first click on a for-profit college website comes only after a vast industrial process has laid the groundwork. Corinthian, for example, had a 30-person marketing team that spent $120 million annually, much of it to generate and pursue 2.4 million leads, which led to 60,000 new students and $600 million in annual revenue. These large marketing teams reach potential students through a wide range of channels, from TV ads and billboards and highways and bus stops, to direct mail, search advertising on Google, and even recruiters visiting schools and knocking on doors. An analyst on the team designs the various promotions with the explicit goal of getting feedback. To optimize recruiting and revenue, they need to know whom their messages reached and, if possible, what impact they had. Only with this data can they go on to optimize the operation. The key for any optimization program, naturally, is to pick an objective. For diploma mills like the University of Phoenix, I think it's safe to say, the goal is to recruit the greatest number of students who can land government loans to pay most of their tuition and fees. With that objective in mind, the data scientists have to figure out how best to manage their various communication channels so that together they generate the most bang for each buck. The data scientists start off with a Bayesian approach, which in statistics is pretty close to plain vanilla. The point of Bayesian analysis is to rank the variables with the most impact on the desired outcome. Search advertising, TV, billboards, and other promotions would each be measured as a function of their effectiveness per dollar. Each develops a different probability, which is expressed as a value or a weight. It gets complicated, though, because the various messaging campaigns all interact with each other, and much of their impact can't be measured. For example, do bus advertisements drive up the probability that a prospect will take a phone call? It's hard to say. It's easier to track online messaging, and for-profits can gather vital details about each prospect, where they live, and what web pages they've surfed. That's why much of the advertising money at for-profit universities goes to Google and Facebook. Each of these platforms allow advertisers to segment their target populations in meticulous detail. Publicists for a Judd Apatow movie, for example, could target males from age 18 to 28 in the 50 richest zip codes, perhaps zeroing in on those who had clicked on or liked links to Apatow's hit movie Trainwreck, have mentioned him on Twitter, or are friends with someone who has. But for-profit colleges hunt in the opposite direction. They're more likely to be targeting people in the poorest zip codes, with special attention to those who have clicked on an ad for payday loans or seem to be concerned with post-traumatic stress. Combat veterans are highly recruited in part because it's easier to get financing for them. The campaign proceeds to run an endless series of competing ads against each other to see which ones bring in the most prospects. This method, based on so-called A-B testing, is one that direct mail marketers have been using for decades. They send a plethora of come-ons, measure the responses, and fine-tune their campaigns. Every time you discover another credit card offer in your mailbox, you're participating in one of those tests. By throwing out the letter unopened, you're providing the company with a valuable piece of data. That campaign didn't work for you. Next time, they'll try a slightly different approach. It may seem fruitless, since so many of these offers wind up in the trash. But for many direct marketers, whether they're operating on the internet or through the mail, a 1% response rate is the stuff of dreams. After all, they're working with huge numbers. 1% of the U.S. population is more than 3 million people. Once these campaigns move online, the learning accelerates. The internet provides advertisers with the greatest laboratory ever for consumer research and lead generation. Feedback from each promotion arrives within seconds, a lot faster than the mail. Within hours instead of months, each campaign can zero in on the most effective messages and come closer to reaching the glittering promise of all advertising, to reach a prospect at the right time and with precisely the best message to trigger a decision, and thus succeed in hauling in another paying customer. This fine-tuning never stops. And increasingly, the data-crunching machines are sifting through our data on their own, searching for our habits and hopes, fears, and desires. With machine learning, a fast-growing domain of artificial intelligence, the computer dives into the data, following only basic instructions. The algorithm finds patterns on its own and then, through time, connects them with outcomes. In a sense, it learns. Compared to the human brain, machine learning isn't especially efficient. A child places her finger on the stove, feels pain, and masters for the rest of her life the correlation between the hot metal and her throbbing hand. And she also picks up the word for it, burn. A machine learning program, by contrast, will often require millions or billions of data points to create a statistical model of cause and effect. But for the first time in history, those petabytes of data are now readily available along with powerful computers to process them. And for many jobs, machine learning proves to be more flexible and nuanced than the traditional programs governed by rules. Language scientists, for example, spent decades, from the 1960s to the early years of this century, trying to teach computers how to read. During most of this time, they programmed definitions and grammatical rules into the code. But, as any foreign language student discovers all too quickly, languages teem with exceptions. They have slang and sarcasm. The meaning of certain words changes with time and geography. The complexity of language is a programmer's nightmare. Ultimately, coding it is hopeless. But with the internet, people across the earth have produced quadrillions of words about our lives and work, our shopping, and our friendships. By doing this, we have unwittingly built the greatest ever training corpus for natural language machines. As we turn from paper to email and social networks, machines could study our words, compare them to others, and gather something about their context. The progress has been fast and dramatic. As late as 2011, Apple underwhelmed most of techdom with its natural language personal assistant, Siri. The technology was conversant only in certain areas, and it made laughable mistakes. Most people I know found it near useless. But now, I hear people talking to their phones all the time, asking for the weather report, sports scores, or directions. Somewhere between 2008 and 2015, give or take, the linguistic skills of algorithms advanced from pre-K to middle school, and for some applications, much higher. These advances in natural language have opened up a motherload of possibilities for advertisers. The programs know what a word means, at least enough to associate it with certain behaviors and outcomes, at least some of the time. Fueled in part by this growing linguistic mastery, advertisers can probe for deeper patterns. An advertising program might start out with the usual demographic and geographic details, but over the course of weeks and months, it begins to learn the patterns of the people it's targeting and to make predictions about their next moves. It gets to know them, and if the program is predatory, it gauges their weaknesses and vulnerabilities and pursues the most efficient path to exploit them. In addition to cutting-edge computer science, predatory advertisers often work with middlemen, who use much cruder methods to target prospects. In 2010, one effective ad featured a photo of President Obama and said, quote, "Obama asks moms to return to school, finish your degree, financial aid available to those who qualify," unquote. The ad suggested that the president had signed a new bill aimed at getting mothers back in school. This was a lie, but if it spurred people to click, it served its purpose. Behind this misleading headline, an entire dirty industry was beavering away. When a consumer clicked on the ad, according to a ProPublica investigation, she was asked a few questions, including her age and phone number, and was immediately contacted by a for-profit school. These callers didn't give her any more information about President Obama's new bill, because it never existed. Instead, they offered to help her borrow money for enrollment. This kind of online targeting is called lead generation. Its goal is to come up with lists of prospects which can be sold, in this case, to for-profit universities. According to the ProPublica report, between 20 and 30% of the promotional budgets at for-profit colleges go to lead generation. For the most promising leads, colleges will pay as much as $150 each. One lead generator, Salt Lake City-based Neutron Interactive, posted fake jobs at websites like Monster.com, as well as ads promising to help people get food stamps and Medicaid coverage, according to David Halperin, a public policy researcher. Using the same optimization methods, they would roll out loads of different ads, measuring their effectiveness for each demographic. The purpose of these ads was to lure desperate job seekers to provide their cell phone numbers. In follow-up calls, only 5% of the people showed interest in college courses. But those names were valuable leads. Each one was worth as much as $85 to for-profit colleges. And they would do everything in their power to make that investment pay off. Within 5 minutes of signing up, according to a U.S. Government Accountability Office report, prospective students could expect to begin receiving calls. One target received more than 180 calls in a single month. The for-profit colleges, of course, have their own methods for generating leads. One of their most valuable tools is a College Board website, the resource that many students use to sign up for SAT tests and research the next step in their lives. According to Mara Tucker, a college preparedness counselor for the Urban Assembly Institute of Math and Science for Young Women, a public school in Brooklyn, the search engine on the website is engineered to direct poor students toward for-profit universities. Once a student has indicated in an online questionnaire that she'll need financial aid, the for-profit colleges pop up at the top of her list of matching schools. For-profit colleges also provide free services in exchange for FaceTime with students. Cassie McGessis, another readiness counselor at the Urban Assembly, told me that the colleges provide free workshops to guide students in writing their resumes. These sessions help the students, but impoverished students who provide their contact information are subsequently stalked. The for-profit colleges do not bother targeting rich students. They and their parents know too much. Recruiting in all of its forms is the heart of the for-profit business, and it accounts for far more of their spending, in most cases, than education. A Senate report on 30 for-profit systems found that they employed one recruiter for every 48 students. Apollo Group, the parent company for the University of Phoenix, spent more than $1 billion on marketing in 2010, almost all of it focused on recruiting. That came out to $2,225 per student on marketing and only $892 per student on instruction. Compare that to Portland Community College in Oregon, which spends $5,953 per student on instruction and about 1.2% of its budget, or $185 per student, on marketing. Math, in the form of complex models, fuels the predatory advertising that brings in prospects for these colleges. But by the time a recruiter is hounding prospective students on their cell phones, we've left the world of numbers behind. The sales pitches, with their promises of affordable tuition, bright career prospects, and upward mobility, aren't that different from the promotions for magic elixirs, baldness cures, and vibrating belts that reduce waistline fat. They're not new. Yet a crucial component of a WMD is that it is damaging to many people's lives. And with these types of predatory ads, the damage doesn't begin until students start taking out big loans for their tuition and fees. The crucial metric is the so-called 90-10 rule, included in the Higher Education Act of 1965. It stipulates that colleges cannot get more than 90% of their funding from federal aid. The thinking was that as long as the students had some skin in the game, they would tend to take their education more seriously. But for-profit colleges quickly worked this ratio into their business plan. If students could scrape together a few thousand dollars either from savings or bank loans, the universities could line them up for 9 times that sum in government loans, making each student incredibly profitable. To many of the students, the loans sound like free money, and the school doesn't take pains to correct this misconception. But it is debt, and many of them quickly find themselves up to their necks in it. The outstanding debt for students at the bankrupt Corinthian colleges amounted to $3.5 billion. Almost all of it was backed by taxpayers and will never be repaid. Some people no doubt attend for-profit colleges and emerge with knowledge and skills that serve them well. But do they fare better than graduates from community colleges whose degrees cost a fraction as much? In 2014, investigators at Calder, American Institutes for Research, created nearly 9,000 fictitious resumes. Some of their fake job applicants held associate degrees from for-profit universities. Others had similar diplomas from community colleges, while a third group had no college education at all. The researchers sent their resumes to job postings in 7 major cities and then measured the response rate. They found that diplomas from for-profit colleges were worth less in the workplace than those from community colleges, and about the same as a high school diploma. And yet these colleges cost on average 20% more than flagship public universities. The feedback loop for this WMD is far less complicated than it is nefarious. The poorest 40% of the U.S. population is in desperate straits. Many industrial jobs have disappeared, either replaced by technology or shipped overseas. Unions have lost their punch. The top 20% of the population controls 89% of the wealth in the country, and the bottom 40% controls none of it. Their assets are negative. The average household in this enormous and struggling underclass has a net debt of $14,800, much of it in extortionate credit card accounts. What these people need is money. And the key to earning more money, they hear again and again, is education. Along come the for-profit colleges with their highly refined WMDs to target and fleece the population most in need. They sell them the promise of an education and a tantalizing glimpse of upward mobility, while plunging them deeper into debt. They take advantage of the pressing need in poor households, along with their ignorance and their aspirations. Then they exploit it. And they do this at great scale. This leads to hopelessness and despair, along with skepticism about the value of education more broadly, and it exacerbates our country's vast wealth gap. It's worth noting that these diploma mills drive inequality in both directions. The presidents of the leading for-profit universities make millions of dollars every year. For example, Gregory W. Capelli, CEO of Apollo Education Group, the parent company of the University of Phoenix, took home $25.1 million in total compensation in 2011. At public universities, which have their own distortions, only football and basketball coaches can hope to make that much. For-profit colleges, sadly, are hardly alone in deploying predatory ads. They have plenty of company. If you just think about where people are hurting or desperate, you'll find advertisers wielding their predatory models. One of the biggest opportunities, naturally, is for loans. Everyone needs money, but some more urgently than others. These people are not hard to find. The neediest are far more likely to reside in impoverished zip codes. And from a predatory advertiser's perspective, they practically shout out for special attention with their queries on search engines and their clicks on coupons. Like for-profit colleges, the payday loan industry operates WMDs. Some of them are run by legal operations, but the industry is fundamentally predatory, charging outrageous interest rates that average 574% on short-term loans that are flipped on average 8 times, making them much more like long-term loans. They are critically supported by legions of data brokers and lead generators, many of them scam artists. Their advertisements pop up on computers and phones, offering fast access to cash. When the prospects fill out the applications, often including their bank information, they open themselves to theft and abuse. In 2015, the Federal Trade Commission charged 2 data brokers for selling the loan applications of more than 500,000 consumers. According to the suit, the companies Sequoia One of Tampa, Florida, and Gen X Marketing Group of nearby Clearwater made off with customers' phone numbers, employer details, social security numbers, and bank account information, and then sold them for about 50 cents each. The companies that bought that information, according to the regulators, raided the consumers' bank accounts for at least $7.1 million. Many of the victims were subsequently charged bank fees for emptying out their accounts or bouncing checks. If you think about the numbers involved, they're almost pathetically low. Spread over 500,000 accounts, $7.1 million comes to barely $14 each. Even if the thieves failed to access many of these accounts, much of the money they stole was no doubt in small numbers, the last $50 or $100 that some poor people keep in their accounts. Now regulators are pushing for new laws governing the market for personal data, a crucial input for all sorts of WMDs. To date, a couple of federal laws, such as the Fair Credit Reporting Act and the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, establish some limits on health and credit data. Maybe, with an eye on lead generators, they'll add more. However, as we'll hear in coming chapters, some of the most effective and nefarious WMDs manage to engineer workarounds. They study everything from neighborhoods to Facebook friends to predict our behavior and even lock us up. Chapter 5. Civilian Casualties. Justice in the Age of Big Data. The small city of Reading, Pennsylvania, has had a tough go of it in the post-industrial era. Nestled in the Green Hills 50 miles west of Philadelphia, Reading grew rich on railroads, steel, coal, and textiles. But in recent decades, with all those industries in steep decline, the city has languished. By 2011, it had the highest poverty rate in the country at 41.3%. The following year, it was surpassed if barely by Detroit. As the recession pummeled Reading's economy following the 2008 market crash, tax revenues fell, which led to a cut of 45 officers in the police department, despite persistent crime. Reading Police Chief William Heim had to figure out how to get the same or better policing out of a smaller force. So in 2013, he invested in crime prediction software made by Predpol, a big data startup based in Santa Cruz, California. The program processed historical crime data and calculated, hour by hour, where crimes were most likely to occur. The Reading policeman could view the program's conclusions as a series of squares, each one just the size of two football fields. If they spent more time patrolling these squares, there was a good chance they would discourage crime. And sure enough, a year later, Chief Heim announced that burglaries were down by 23%. Predictive programs like Predpol are all the rage in budget-strapped police departments across the country. Departments from Atlanta to Los Angeles are deploying cops in the shifting squares and reporting falling crime rates. New York City uses a similar program called CompStat. And Philadelphia police are using a local product called HunchLab that includes risk terrain analysis, which incorporates certain features, such as ATMs or convenience stores, that might attract crimes. Like those in the rest of the big data industry, the developers of crime prediction software are hurrying to incorporate any information that can boost the accuracy of their models. If you think about it, hotspot predictors are similar to the shifting defensive models in baseball that we discussed earlier. Those systems look at the history of each player's hits and then position fielders where the ball is most likely to travel. Crime prediction software carries out similar analysis, positioning cops where crimes appear most likely to occur. Both types of models optimize resources. But a number of the crime prediction models are more sophisticated because they predict progressions that could lead to waves of crime. Predpol, for example, is based on seismic software. It looks at a crime in one area, incorporates it into historical patterns, and predicts when and where it might occur next. One simple correlation it has found: if burglars hit your next-door neighbor's house, batten down the hatches. Predictive crime models like Predpol have their virtues. Unlike the Crime Stoppers in Steven Spielberg's dystopian movie Minority Report, and some ominous real-life initiatives which we'll get to shortly, the cops don't track down people before they commit crimes. Jeffrey Brantingham, the UCLA anthropology professor who founded Predpol, stressed to me that the model is blind to race and ethnicity. And unlike other programs, including the recidivism risk models we discussed, which are used for sentencing guidelines, Predpol doesn't focus on the individual. Instead, it targets geography. The key inputs are the type and location of each crime and when it occurred. That seems fair enough. And if cops spend more time in the high-risk zones, foiling burglars and car thieves, there's good reason to believe that the community benefits. But most crimes aren't as serious as burglary and grand theft auto, and that is where serious problems emerge. When police set up their Predpol system, they have a choice. They can focus exclusively on so-called Part 1 crimes. These are the violent crimes, including homicide, arson, and assault, which are usually reported to them. But they can also broaden the focus by including Part 2 crimes, including vagrancy, aggressive panhandling, and selling and consuming small quantities of drugs. Many of these nuisance crimes would go unrecorded if a cop weren't there to see them. These nuisance crimes are endemic to many impoverished neighborhoods. In some places, police call them antisocial behavior, or ASB. Unfortunately, including them in the model threatens to skew the analysis. Once the nuisance data flows into a predictive model, more police are drawn into those neighborhoods, where they're more likely to arrest more people. After all, even if their objective is to stop burglaries, murders, and rape, they're bound to have slow periods. It's the nature of patrolling. And if a patrolling cop sees a couple of kids who look no older than 16, guzzling from a bottle in a brown bag, he stops them. These types of low-level crimes populate their models with more and more dots, and the models send the cops back to the same neighborhood. This creates a pernicious feedback loop. The policing itself spawns new data, which justifies more policing. And our prisons fill up with hundreds of thousands of people found guilty of victimless crimes. Most of them come from impoverished neighborhoods, and most are Black or Hispanic. So even if a model is colorblind, the result of it is anything but. In our largely segregated cities, geography is a highly effective proxy for race. If the purpose of the models is to prevent serious crimes, you might ask why nuisance crimes are tracked at all. The answer is that the link between antisocial behavior and crime has been an article of faith since 1982, when a criminologist named George Kelling teamed up with a public policy expert, James Q. Wilson, to write a seminal article in the Atlantic Monthly on so-called broken windows policing. The idea was that low-level crimes and misdemeanors created an atmosphere of disorder in a neighborhood. This scared law-abiding citizens away. The dark and empty streets they left behind were breeding grounds for serious crime. The antidote was for society to resist the spread of disorder. This included fixing broken windows, cleaning up graffiti-covered subway cars, and taking steps to discourage nuisance crimes. This thinking led, in the 1990s, to zero-tolerance campaigns, most famously in New York City. Cops would arrest kids for jumping the subway turnstiles. They'd apprehend people caught sharing a single joint and rumble them around the city in a paddy wagon for hours before eventually booking them. Some credited these energetic campaigns for dramatic falls in violent crimes. Others disagreed. The authors of the best-selling book Freakonomics went so far as to correlate the drop in crime to the legalization of abortion in the 1970s. And plenty of other theories also surfaced, ranging from the falling rates of crack cocaine addiction to the booming 1990s economy. In any case, the zero-tolerance movement gained broad support, and the criminal justice system sent millions of mostly young minority men to prison, many of them for minor offenses. But zero-tolerance actually had very little to do with Kelling and Wilson's broken windows thesis. Their case study focused on what appeared to be a successful policing initiative in Newark, New Jersey. Cops who walked the beat there, according to the program, were supposed to be highly tolerant. Their job was to adjust to the neighborhood's own standards of order and to help uphold them. Standards varied from one part of the city to another. In one neighborhood, it might mean that drunks had to keep their bottles in bags and avoid major streets, but that side streets were okay. Addicts could sit on stoops, but not lie down. The idea was only to make sure the standards didn't fall. The cops in this scheme were helping a neighborhood maintain its own order, but not imposing their own. You might think I'm straying a bit from PredPol, mathematics, and WMDs. But each policing approach, from broken windows to zero tolerance, represents a model. Just like my meal planning or the U.S. News top college ranking, each crime-fighting model calls for certain input data, followed by a series of responses, and each is calibrated to achieve an objective. It's important to look at policing this way because these mathematical models now dominate law enforcement, and some of them are WMDs. That said, we can understand why police departments would choose to include nuisance data. Raised on the orthodoxy of zero tolerance, many have little more reason to doubt the link between small crimes and big ones than the correlation between smoke and fire. When police in the British city of Kent tried out PredPol in 2013, they incorporated nuisance crime data into their model. It seemed to work. They found that the PredPol squares were 10 times as efficient as random patrolling and twice as precise as analysis delivered by police intelligence. And what type of crimes did the model best predict? Nuisance crimes. This makes all the sense in the world. A drunk will pee on the same wall day in and day out, and a junkie will stretch out on the same park bench, while a car thief or a burglar will move about, working hard to anticipate the movements of police. Even as police chiefs stress the battle against violent crime, it would take remarkable restraint not to let loads of nuisance data flow into their predictive models. More data, it's easy to believe, is better data. While a model focusing only on violent crimes may produce a sparse constellation on the screen, the inclusion of nuisance data would create a fuller and more vivid portrait of lawlessness in the city. And in most jurisdictions, sadly, such a crime map would track poverty. The high number of arrests in those areas would do nothing but confirm the broadly shared thesis of society's middle and upper classes, that poor people are responsible for their own shortcomings and commit most of a city's crimes. But what if police looked for different kinds of crimes? That may sound counterintuitive because most of us, including the police, view crime as a pyramid. At the top is homicide. It's followed by rape and assault, which are more common. And then shoplifting, petty fraud, and even parking violations, which happen all the time. Prioritizing the crimes at the top of the pyramid makes sense. Minimizing violent crime, most would agree, is and should be a central part of a police force's mission. But how about crimes far removed from the boxes on the PredPol maps, the ones carried out by the rich? In the 2000s, the kings of finance threw themselves a lavish party. They lied, they bet billions against their own customers, they committed fraud, and paid off rating agencies. Enormous crimes were committed there, and the result devastated the global economy for the best part of 5 years. Millions of people lost their homes, jobs, and healthcare. We have every reason to believe that more such crimes are occurring in finance right now. If we've learned anything, it's that the driving goal of the finance world is to make a huge profit, the bigger the better, and that anything resembling self-regulation is worthless. Thanks largely to the industry's wealth and powerful lobbies, finance is under-policed. Just imagine if police enforced their zero-tolerance strategy in finance. They would arrest people for even the slightest infraction, whether it was chiseling investors on 401ks, providing misleading guidance, or committing petty frauds. Perhaps SWAT teams would descend on Greenwich, Connecticut. They'd go undercover in the taverns around Chicago's Mercantile Exchange. Not likely, of course. The cops don't have the expertise for that kind of work. Everything about their jobs, from the training to their bulletproof vests, is adapted to the mean streets. Clamping down on white-collar crime would require people with different tools and skills. The small and underfunded teams who handle that work, from the FBI to investigators at the Security and Exchange Commission, have learned through the decades that bankers are virtually invulnerable. They spend heavily on our politicians, which always helps, and are also viewed as crucial to our economy. That protects them. If their banks go south, our economy could go with them. The poor have no such argument. So, except for a couple of criminal outliers, such as Ponzi scheme master Bernard Madoff, financiers don't get arrested. As a group, they made it through the 2008 market crash practically unscathed. What could ever burn them now? My point is that police make choices about where they direct their attention. Today they focus almost exclusively on the poor. That's their heritage and their mission, as they understand it. And now data scientists are stitching the status quo of the social order into models like PredPol that hold ever greater sway over our lives. The result is that while PredPol delivers a perfectly useful and even high-minded software tool, it is also a do-it-yourself WMD. In this sense, PredPol, even with the best of intentions, empowers police departments to zero in on the poor, stopping more of them, arresting a portion of those, and sending a subgroup to prison. And the police chiefs, in many cases, if not most, think that they're taking the only sensible route to combating crime. That's where it is, they say, pointing to the highlighted ghetto on the map. And now they have cutting-edge technology, powered by big data, reinforcing their position there while addressing precision and science into the process. The result is that we criminalize poverty, believing all the while that our tools are not only scientific, but fair. One weekend in the spring of 2011, I attended a data hackathon in New York City. The goal of such events is to bring together hackers, nerds, mathematicians, and software geeks, and to mobilize this brain power to shine light on the digital systems that wield so much power in our lives. I was paired up with the New York City Civil Liberties Union, and our job was to break out the data on one of NYPD's major anti-crime policies, so-called stop, question, and frisk. Known simply as stop and frisk to most people, the practice had drastically increased in the data-driven age of CompStat. The police regarded stop and frisk as a filtering device for crime. The idea is simple. Police officers stop people who look suspicious to them. It could be the way they're walking or dressed, or their tattoos. The police talk to them and size them up, often while they're spread-eagled against a wall or the hood of a car. They ask for their ID, and they frisk them. Stop enough people, the thinking goes, and you'll no doubt stop loads of petty crimes and perhaps some big ones. The policy, implemented by Mayor Michael Bloomberg's administration, had loads of public support. Over the previous decade, the number of stops had risen by 600% to nearly 700,000 incidents. The great majority of those stopped were innocent. For them, these encounters were highly unpleasant, even infuriating. Yet many in the public associated the program with a sharp decline of crime in the city. New York, many felt, was safer, and statistics indicated as much. Homicides, which had reached 2,245 in 1990, were down to 515, and would drop below 400 by 2014. Everyone knew that an outsized proportion of the people the police stopped were young, dark-skinned men. But how many did they stop? And how often did these encounters lead to arrests or stop crimes? While this information was technically public, much of it was stored in a database that was hard to access. The software didn't work on our computers or flow into Excel spreadsheets. Our job at the hackathon was to break open that program and free the data so that we could all analyze the nature and effectiveness of the stop and frisk program. What we found, to no great surprise, was that an overwhelming majority of these encounters, about 85%, involved young African American or Latino men. In certain neighborhoods, many of them were stopped repeatedly. Only 0.1%, or one of 1,000 stopped, was linked in any way to a violent crime. Yet, this filter captured many others for lesser crimes, from drug possession to underage drinking, that might have otherwise gone undiscovered. Some of the targets, as you might expect, got angry, and a good number of those found themselves charged with resisting arrest. The NYCLU sued the Bloomberg administration, charging that the stop-and-frisk policy was racist. It was an example of uneven policing, one that pushed more minorities into the criminal justice system and into prison. Black men, they argued, were 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white men, and 21 times more likely to be killed by police, at least according to the available data, which is famously underreported. Stop and frisk isn't exactly a WMD because it relies on human judgment and is not formalized into an algorithm, but it is built upon a simple and destructive calculation. If police stop 1,000 people in certain neighborhoods, they'll uncover, on average, one significant suspect and lots of smaller ones. This isn't so different from the long-shot calculations used by predatory advertisers or spammers. Even when the hit ratio is minuscule, if you give yourself enough chances, you'll reach your target. And that helps to explain why the program grew so dramatically under Bloomberg's watch. If stopping 6 times as many people led to 6 times the number of arrests, the inconvenience and harassment suffered by thousands upon thousands of innocent people was justified. Weren't they interested in stopping crime? Aspects of stop and frisk were similar to WMDs, though. For example, it had a nasty feedback loop. It ensnared thousands of Black and Latino men, many of them for committing the petty crimes and misdemeanors that go on in college frats, unpunished, every Saturday night. But while the great majority of university students were free to sleep off their excesses, the victims of stop and frisk were booked, and some of them were dispatched to the hell that is Rikers Island. What's more, each arrest created new data, further justifying the policy. As stop and frisk grew, the venerable legal concept of probable cause was rendered virtually meaningless, because police were hunting not only people who might have already committed a crime, but also those who might commit one in the future. Sometimes, no doubt, they accomplished this goal. By arresting a young man whose suspicious bulge turned out to be an unregistered gun, they might be saving the neighborhood from a murder or armed robbery, or even a series of them. Or maybe not. Whatever the case, there was a logic to stop and frisk, and many found it persuasive. But was the policy constitutional? In August of 2013, federal judge Shira A. Shindlin ruled that it was not. She said officers routinely, quote, stopped Blacks and Hispanics who would not have been stopped if they were white. Stop and frisk, she wrote, ran afoul of the Fourth Amendment, which protects against unreasonable searches and seizures by the government, and it also failed to provide the equal protection guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. She called for broad reforms to the practice, including increased use of body cameras and patrolling policemen. This would help establish probable cause, or the lack of it, and remove some of the opacity from the stop and frisk model. But it would do nothing to address the issue of uneven policing. While looking at WMDs, we're often faced with a choice between fairness and efficacy. Our legal traditions lean strongly towards fairness. The Constitution, for example, presumes innocence and is engineered to value it. From a modeler's perspective, the presumption of innocence is a constraint, and the result is that some guilty people go free, especially those who can afford good lawyers. Even those found guilty have the right to appeal their verdict, which chews up time and resources. So the system sacrifices enormous efficiencies for the promise of fairness. The Constitution's implicit judgment is that freeing someone who may well have committed a crime, for lack of evidence, poses less of a danger to our society than jailing or executing an innocent person. WMDs, by contrast, tend to favor efficiency. By their very nature, they feed on data that can be measured and counted. But fairness is squishy and hard to quantify. It is a concept, and computers, for all their advances in language and logic, still struggle mightily with concepts. They understand beauty only as a word associated with the Grand Canyon, ocean sunsets, and grooming tips in Vogue magazine. They try in vain to measure friendship by counting likes and connections on Facebook. And the concept of fairness utterly escapes them. Programmers don't know how to code for it, and few of their bosses ask them to. So fairness isn't calculated into WMDs, and the result is massive industrial production of unfairness. If you think of a WMD as a factory, Unfairness is the black stuff belching out of the smokestacks. It's an emission, a toxic one. The question is whether we as a society are willing to sacrifice a bit of efficiency in the interest of fairness. Should we handicap the models, leaving certain data out? It's possible, for example, that adding gigabytes of data about antisocial behavior might help PredPol predict the mapping coordinates for serious crimes. But this comes at the cost of a nasty feedback loop. So I'd argue that we should discard the data. It's a tough case to make, similar in many ways to the battles over wiretapping by the National Security Agency. Advocates of the snooping argue that it's important for our safety, and those running our vast national security apparatus will keep pushing for more information to fulfill their mission. They'll continue to encroach on people's privacy until they get the message that they must find a way to do their job within the bounds of the Constitution. It might be harder, but it's necessary. The other issue is equality. Would society be so willing to sacrifice the concept of probable cause if everyone had to endure the harassment and indignities of stop and frisk? Chicago police have their own stop and frisk program. In the name of fairness, what if they sent a bunch of patrollers into the city's exclusive Gold Coast? Maybe they'd arrest joggers for jaywalking from the park across West North Boulevard, or crack down on poodle pooping along Lakeshore Drive. This heightened police presence would probably pick up more drunk drivers and perhaps uncover a few cases of insurance fraud, spousal abuse, or racketeering. Occasionally, just to give everyone a taste of the unvarnished experience, the cops might throw wealthy citizens on the trunks of their cruisers, wrench their arms, and snap on the handcuffs, perhaps while swearing and calling them hateful names. In time, this focus on the Gold Coast would create data. It would describe an increase in crime there, which would draw even more police into the fray. This would no doubt lead to growing anger and confrontations. I picture a double Parker talking back to police, refusing to get out of his Mercedes, and finding himself facing charges for resisting arrest. Yet another Gold Coast crime. This may sound less than serious, but a crucial part of justice is equality. And that means, among other things, experiencing criminal justice equally. People who favor policies like stop and frisk should experience it themselves. Justice cannot just be something that one part of society inflicts upon the other. The noxious effects of uneven policing, whether from stop and frisk or predictive models like PredPol, do not end when the accused are arrested and booked in the criminal justice system. Once there, many of them confront another WMD that I discussed in Chapter 1, the recidivism model used for sentencing guidelines. The bias data from uneven policing funnels right into this model. Judges then look to this supposedly scientific analysis crystallized into a single risk score. And those who take this score seriously have reason to give longer sentences to prisoners who appear to pose a higher risk of committing other crimes. And why are non-white prisoners from poor neighborhoods more likely to commit crimes? According to the data inputs for the recidivism models, it's because they're more likely to be jobless, lack a high school diploma, and have previous run-ins with the law. And their friends have too. Another way of looking at the same data, though, is that these prisoners live in poor neighborhoods with terrible schools and scant opportunities. And they're highly policed. So the chance that an ex-convict returning to that neighborhood will have another brush with the law is no doubt larger than that of a tax fraudster who is released into a leafy suburb. In this system, the poor and non-white are punished more for being who they are and living where they live. What's more, for supposedly scientific systems, the recidivism models are logically flawed. The unquestioned assumption is that locking away high-risk prisoners for more time makes society safer. It is true, of course, that prisoners don't commit crimes against society while behind bars. But is it possible that their time in prison has an effect on their behavior once they step out? Is there a chance that years in a brutal environment surrounded by felons might make them more likely, and not less, to commit another crime? Such a finding would undermine the very basis of the recidivism sentencing guidelines. But prison systems, which are awash in data, do not carry out this highly important research. All too often, they use data to justify the workings of the system, but not to question or improve the system. Compare this attitude to the one found at Amazon.com. The giant retailer, like the criminal justice system, is highly focused on a form of recidivism. But Amazon's goal is the opposite. It wants people to come back again and again to buy. Its software system targets recidivism and encourages it. Now, if Amazon operated like the justice system, it would start by scoring shoppers as potential recidivists. Maybe more of them live in certain area codes or have college degrees. In this case, Amazon would market more to these people, perhaps offering them discounts. And if the marketing worked, those with high recidivist scores would come back to shop more. If viewed superficially, the results would appear to corroborate Amazon's scoring system. But unlike the WMDs in criminal justice, Amazon does not settle for such glib correlations. The company runs a data laboratory, and if it wants to find out what drives shopping recidivism, it carries out research. Its data scientists don't just study zip codes and education levels, they also inspect people's experience within the Amazon ecosystem. They might start by looking at the patterns of all the people who shopped once or twice at Amazon and never returned. Did they have trouble at checkout? Did their packages arrive on time? Did a higher percentage of them post a bad review? The questions go on and on because the future of the company hinges upon a system that learns continually, one that figures out what makes customers tick. If I had a chance to be a data scientist for the justice system, I would do my best to dig deeply, to learn what goes on inside those prisons, and what impact those experiences might have on prisoners' behavior. I'd first look into solitary confinement. Hundreds of thousands of prisoners are kept for 23 hours a day in these prisons within prisons, most of them no bigger than a horse stall. Researchers have found that time in solitary produces deep feelings of hopelessness and despair. Could that have any impact on recidivism? That's a test I'd love to run, but I'm not sure the data is even collected. How about rape? In Unfair, the New Science of Criminal Injustice, Adam Benforado writes that certain types of prisoners are targeted for rape in prisons. The young and small of stature are especially vulnerable, as are the mentally disabled. Some of these people live for years as sex slaves. It's another important topic for analysis that anyone with relevant data and expertise could work out, but prison systems have thus far been uninterested in cataloging the long-term effects of this abuse. A serious scientist would also search for positive signals from the prison experience. What's the impact of more sunlight, more sports, better food, literacy training? Maybe these factors will improve convicts' behavior after they go free. More likely, they'll have varying impact. A serious justice system research program would delve into the effects of each of these elements, how they work together, and which people they're most likely to help. The goal, if data were used constructively, would be to optimize prisons, much the way companies like Amazon optimize websites or supply chains, for the benefit of both the prisoners and society at large. But prisons have every incentive to avoid this data-driven approach. The PR risks are too great. No city wants to be the subject of a scathing report in the New York Times. And of course, there's big money riding on the overcrowded prison system. Privately run prisons, which house only 10% of the incarcerated population, are a $5 billion industry. Like airlines, the private prisons make profits only when running at high capacity. Too much poking and prodding might threaten that income source. So instead of analyzing prisons and optimizing them, we deal with them as black boxes. Prisoners go in and disappear from our view. Nastiness no doubt occurs, but behind thick walls. What goes on in there? Don't ask. The current models stubbornly stick to the dubious and unquestioned hypothesis that more prison time for supposedly high-risk prisoners makes us safer. And if studies appear to upend that logic, they can be easily ignored. And this is precisely what happens. Consider a recidivism study by Michigan economics professor Michael Mueller-Smith. After studying 2.6 million criminal court records in Harris County, Texas, he concluded that the longer inmates in Harris County, Texas spent locked up, the greater the chance that they would fail to find employment upon release, would require food stamps and other public assistance, and would commit further crimes. But to turn those conclusions into smart policy and better justice, politicians will have to take a stand on behalf of a feared minority that many, if not most, voters would much prefer to ignore. It's a tough sell. Stop and frisk may seem intrusive and unfair, but in short time it will also be viewed as primitive. That's because police are bringing back tools and techniques from the global campaign on terrorism and focusing them on local crime fighting. In San Diego, for example, police are not only asking the people they stop for identification or frisking them. On occasion, they also take photos of them with iPads and send them to a cloud-based facial recognition service which matches them against a database of criminals and suspects. According to a report in the New York Times, San Diego police used this facial recognition program on 20,600 people between 2011 and 2015. They also probed many of them with mouth swabs to harvest DNA. Advances in facial recognition technology will soon allow for much broader surveillance. Officials in Boston, for example, were considering using security cameras to scan thousands of faces at outdoor concerts. This data would be uploaded to a service that could match each face against a million others per second. In the end, officials decided against it. Concern for privacy on that occasion trumped efficiency. But this won't always be the case. As technology advances, we're sure to see a dramatic growth of surveillance. The good news, if you want to call it that, is that once thousands of security cameras in our cities and towns are sending up our images for analysis, police won't have to discriminate as much. And the technology will no doubt be useful for tracking down suspects, as happened in the Boston Marathon bombing. But it means that we'll all be subject to a digital form of stop and frisk, our faces matched against databases of known criminals and terrorists. The focus then may well shift towards spotting potential lawbreakers, not just neighborhoods or squares on a map, but individuals. These preemptive campaigns, already well established in the fight against terrorism, are a breeding ground for WMDs. In 2009, the Chicago Police Department received a $2 million grant from the National Institute of Justice to develop a predictive program for crime. The theory behind Chicago's winning application was that with enough research and data, they might be able to demonstrate that the spread of crime, like epidemics, follows certain patterns. It can be predicted and hopefully prevented. The scientific leader of the Chicago initiative was Miles Wernick, the director of the Medical Imaging Research Center at the Illinois Institute of Technology, IIT. Decades earlier, Wernick had helped the U.S. military analyze data to pick out battlefield targets. He had since moved to medical data analysis, including the progression of dementia. But, like most data scientists, he didn't see his expertise as tethered to a specific industry. He spotted patterns, and his focus in Chicago would be the patterns of crime and of criminals. The early efforts of Wernick's team focused on singling out hotspots for crime, much as PredPol does. But the Chicago team went much further. They developed a list of the approximately 400 people most likely to commit a violent crime, and it ranked them on the probability that they would be involved in a homicide. One of the people on the list, a 22-year-old high school dropout named Robert McDaniel, answered his door one summer day in 2013 and found himself facing a police officer. McDaniel later told the Chicago Tribune that he had no history of gun violations and had never been charged with a violent crime. Like most of the young men in Austin, his dangerous West Side neighborhood, McDaniel had had brushes with the law, and he knew plenty of people caught up in the criminal justice system. The policewoman, he said, told him that the force had its eye on him and to watch out. Part of the analysis that led police to McDaniel involved his social network. He knew criminals. And there is no denying that people are statistically more likely than not to behave like the people they spend time with. Facebook, for example, has found that friends who communicate often are far more likely to click on the same advertisement. Birds of a feather, statistically speaking, do fly together. And to be fair to Chicago police, they're not arresting people like Robert McDaniel, at least not yet. The goal of the police in this exercise is to save lives. If the 400 people who appear most likely to commit violent crimes receive a knock on the door and a warning, maybe some of them will think twice before packing a gun. But let's consider McDaniel's case in terms of fairness. He happened to grow up in a poor and dangerous neighborhood. In this, he was unlucky. He has been surrounded by crime, and many of his acquaintances have gotten caught up in it. And largely because of these circumstances and not his own actions, he has been deemed dangerous. Now the police have their eye on him. And if he behaves foolishly, as millions of other Americans do on a regular basis, if he buys drugs or gets into a barroom fight or carries an unregistered handgun, the full force of the law will fall down on him, and probably much harder than it would on most of us. After all, he's been warned. I would argue that the model that led police to Robert McDaniel's door has the wrong objective. Instead of simply trying to eradicate crimes, police should be attempting to build relationships in the neighborhood. This was one of the pillars of the original Broken Windows study. The cops were on foot, talking to people, trying to help them uphold their own community standards. But that objective, in many cases, has been lost, steamrolled by models that equate arrests with safety. This isn't the case everywhere. I recently visited Camden, New Jersey, which was the murder capital of the country in 2011. I found that the police department in Camden, rebuilt and placed under state control in 2012, had a dual mandate, lowering crime and engendering community trust. If building trust is the objective, an arrest may well become a last resort.